Derek Warren here in studio with the FEM County Cultural Center and Museum President, Delaney Donaldson. Thanks for joining me again today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure always to be with you.
Yeah, part of our monthly series of interviews. I'm not for sure exactly. You said this is a subdivision that hasn't been really talked about much at all, so I'll just let you take it away. What's the topic?
Okay, so the subdivision that I'm talking about today is called Craik's Terrace. And it came as a surprise to me, too. I was going through some old newspapers, and all of a sudden I find an artist sketch of the new subdivision that was going to be added to Effingham. And it has pictures of the two pillars that were going to be entryways, and there were different sets of these that were placed around the subdivision where people entered the actual subdivision. And now, if you come into Effingham and you go to the Effingham Museum and visit with us, which we would encourage you to do, that you will see two pillars that are out on the south side of the building on the sidewalk that leads up to the front entranceway. Those two pillars were originally pillars that were entryways into Craik's subdivision.
A little bit of history there, something moved across town.
Yeah, you know, when I was a child growing up, one of the houses we lived in was on Craik Street. It wasn't in that neighborhood right there, but it was Craik Street, which was the south boundary of the subdivision.
Okay.
And so it was something I had never, ever known. And I did kind of a double take when I looked at those images there in the newspaper, and I thought, well, what on earth is this? I never heard of this. And then also... And I'll probably mention this again, but as they laid out the streets, Craik Street was on the south boundary of that. Wabash was the north boundary of that. Okay. And then in the middle, there's Douglas Street today.
Right.
All right. Originally, it was called Douglas Boulevard. So they had some high ambitions that I don't ever think came into existence there, because I don't see any boulevard there today, nor when I was a child did I ever see a boulevard there. But they had some high ambitions for that. But it's an interesting story. But, you know, the development of any town is an interesting kind of pattern that I think that we sometimes lose sight of, and the creativity that went into a lot of the building of any community, no matter where it is, throughout the United States. You know, because if we look at the nature of Effingham, we know that the reason why we had a town here, period, why we had a town here, it was the fact that the National Road was a major thoroughfare through this area heading west. And then the railroads coming in made a crossroads here. You know, everything was perfect for transportation purposes and so on. Now, prior to that, there had been the plan of what was called Brough Road. There was a governor of Indiana who was a land speculator, and he had purchased property close to where the railroads he thought were going to come through east and west. Now, that didn't materialize for a long time. But this man had bought property along the way, so that the original community of what is now Effingham was two towns, actually. It was Bruffton and Effingham side by side. So, and speculators were putting the money into it because they were counting on this being a commercial center of some sort.
Before Totopolis, then?
I'm just talking about the community of Effingham itself.
Okay.
Because the original county seat of Effingham was Ewington.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, and so then Effingham came about as a town because of the crossroads, and that's why Ewington then dissolved and became part of Effingham. The people just literally packed up and moved whatever they had over to this area. Now, also, I've done a lot of study about Reverend Alfred Bliss. It was Bliss Park that is here in Effingham.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Reverend Bliss was a reverend. He was a very successful farmer before he decided he would become a preacher. And he was a man who, with his son-in-law, saw a lot of opportunity in Effingham for land speculation. And so when he came into town, he said that the only thing that existed in terms of the community of Effingham was the land that was north of the railroad tracks. And so he said he and his son-in-law looked over this pretty big expanse that had one house on it south of the tracks, and that was it. And he said that Reverend Bliss then said to his son-in-law, why don't we track down whoever owns this property and let's just buy it? And so they did, and they developed then the Bliss Park addition. Okay, and so all of these things were developed. And so, you know, and so there have been a lot of speculators who have been very important in terms of the development of Effingham.
Yeah, around Bliss Park, you got the brick road right there. I'm pretty sure that that is a carryover from initial, right?
Well, that goes back to the Depression days, I believe.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. But anyhow, these people were really, really important in terms of how the city would grow, because they were willing to take a chance on buying property, developing property, and then hoping that the crowds would come and that the community they were sure was going to grow and grow and grow and grow. So, and it did go from 200 up to, you know, about 5,000 within a less than a 50-year time period. So that's pretty good growth that took place. And so those pillars that are up there, if you come up to the museum, then remember that those two pillars originally were the entryways to Craik's subdivision. Now, it's interesting if you go back to the old newspapers and start looking at how all of this happened, because there were communities, was a community that wanted to attract businesses, factories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And so as they began to look around for what they could do, they knew that there had to be housing provided. Housing is always a constant need. If you look at newspapers today and you look at any community that is experiencing any growth, is we need more houses. We need affordable houses within Effingham. We need this, still an appeal that is out there. So the speculators are always there. And so what happened was in 1916, there was this need for housing, definitely. And so we have some very wise people who then began to say, okay, we could develop this area that has not really been developed beyond Wabash Avenue. Because when Bliss was developing his section there, that it was down to, it was bounded on the south by Wabash, where the old, where the Illinois College of Photography was, the Garnet Hall of the present, of the Austin Mansion originally is what that was. Okay, so there was nothing that was developed south of that. And so some speculators saw, okay, we can develop that land too and provide houses for people who are going to be coming in, whether they are in a professional status, professors at the college here that was in Effingham, the Austin College, or it could be for people who could work in Effingham at the factories that were beginning to develop, factories that were relatively close because there were factories on the south end of town. And so the subdivision was going to be there, and it was going to be something that people could be very proud of. And these were individuals who had a lot of dreaming ability, I guess. They could imagine what could be happening. And so in 1916, after approval through the city fathers for this development to take place, then in September of 1916, this is during World War I. U.S. hasn't entered the war at this particular point, but World War I was taking place. So there was a lot of global conflict here, or throughout the world. And so the 1916 September announcement was made, work has started on the Craik subdivision. Now, the Craiks that had were going to develop this had, and they this was publicized in the blue paper also, they had this land that had been bought by one of their ancestors in 1850. Zachary Taylor's signature, they said, was on the deed, the original deed of the property. Way back then, you know, this was before there was an Effingham as such.
Right, okay? Yeah.
Because that didn't come for a few more years beyond that. But in this newspaper, then, it described everything was going to take place. They were going to have decent sewers. They were going to have decent water. They were going to have decent shrubbery and trees and make it a very attractive place for people. And so it would be this area with Craik Street as the south boundary. Douglas Boulevard was going to be there in the middle, and then Wabash would be the northern boundary. It never came about that there was a boulevard developed. But as I was a child growing up, one of the things I always remember were those pillars that were there on 5th Street, this side of Wabash Street on 5th Street. There were pillars on the corner. And then there were pillars that were along 4th Street Clyde Martin's house, when Clyde Martin was our mayor and the owner of IGA, that his house was one that had pillars in it. And then across the street from that, when I was a youngster in school, there was a teacher, Mrs. Brisenden, who lived in that house right across the corner. And there were those pillars that were sitting there as well. Then on Park Street, if you were to go down there, you would have seen another set of pillars that led into the area. So this was a pretty fancy thing, you know, these pillars that were there as markers to show this is going to be a real showcase for housing in Effingham.
Just so people know, not everybody knows, the Boulevard is more it tends to be more upscale neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. That's usually has
a center area that has shrubbery and the like in it. You know, so you got two separate lanes separated by the boulevard down the middle of it.
Okay.
So that is what we were looking at. Is that began to develop, and then they began to advertise in the newspaper, putting large ads in the newspaper that would show all of the lots that were available. And just lots and lots that were available. So then people began to say, okay, I will make a purchase. So one of the professors at the Austin College decided that he would make a purchase of the property. He was not at Austin College, but he was Illinois College of Photography. But in the Illinois College of Photography, and he wanted to make a purchase there. That would make sense. You know, he'd be right across the street.
Yeah.
Walk down a little ways. And he would be there where he was going to teach. And so he indicated he wanted to buy property there. There was a Dr. Henry who also wanted to buy a lot. And these were the two earliest that were there. So it appeared as though, excuse my throat here, it appeared as though there were going to be professional people who would be moving in here. And that would be a different than working neighborhood. It would be probably one that would have a lot of wealthier people in it. And so those two men made early purchases, and they were going to start building right away. But when they were going to start building then is when the United States entered World War I, and I think everything just kind of came to a screeching halt for most people. They didn't know what the world was going to at that time. So Professor Cook was going to go ahead, and he was going to continue with his plans to try to make them happen soon. But Dr. Henry kind of put his on hold for a number of years before he then constructed his house.
He wanted to make sure it's going to be a good world to build in, basically.
Precisely. You know, because there was a lot of fear about whether or not the world could be made safe for democracy, what was going to happen, and our involvement. We knew this was a bloody, bloody affair. But anyhow, then there was this date set for selling the lots, October of 1916. There were other kinds of things that were there, talking about the fact that there were graded streets, there were sidewalks, there were ornamental columns, there were electric lights by that time, and all the city conveniences. And then they put this advertisement in, which really caught my eye. How much do those lots cost? Because you look in the newspaper today and you'll see lots for tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Okay. Bargain prices, $195 to $435 a piece, except for the two corner lots that are a little bit higher. $25 cash down, $10 a month was what it took to buy the lots.
Well, I assume that's worth a lot more nowadays.
Exactly.
The current money, like what it would be worth now, but that's really cheap for land at that point, I would imagine.
And I'm sure that young people looking at this would say, whoa, I can't believe.
I can make that much in a few days. Yeah, that's not the way it was then, though.
Make that much in an hour, you know. Yeah, right. Okay. So they're looking at this and they're saying, okay. Now, you know, very different economic times back then. And so then they began to advertise, and they began to sell more lots, and people would come in. And if you go to that section of town that we're just describing there, you'll see a lot of brick houses. So a lot of the early houses there were brick houses. And so it was something that they thought had a lot of class to it. Now, here is also the situation, though. As more people were going to come into town, they were sure of that for new factories that were coming into town, et cetera, that there were going to be more and more people coming into town. And as those more and more people came into town, that probably meant more kids for schools.
Yeah.
Now, at that time, we had two grade schools in town. We had East Side School and we had West Side School.
Okay.
And those two. Now, just from a personal standpoint, when I was in my earliest years, my grade school years, my family lived at the corner of Mulberry and Shelby Street, close to West Side School. Now, I remember going to West Side School. It was an old building. I didn't realize how old it was until just recently. But it was built in the 1870s. So I was entering school at the end of the 40s and into the 50s. So I remember that old building, and our kids would go and they would pick away at the mortar, you know, between the bricks at lunchtime. Well, then by the time I got to fifth grade, then the decision had been made that school was going to come down and a new one was built. So at the end of my fifth grade year, the students moved the things from the old South Side School into the new West Side School, things that still had to be gone, you know, the books and things like that sort.
We took across
over to that, you know. And so it was a different kind of thing that was taking place. Now, I also then went to South Side School, which was built in 1917, because my dad was a building contractor here in town, and he had built a house for us on Craig Street. And so Southside was going to be my new school to go to. Okay. It was an old school, and it was built in 1917, and then had many additions through the years to it, you know, and eventually then the old school all came down. Now, the school board looked at that particular need that they knew was coming. So this is wisdom on their part. They're looking and they're saying, okay, we're going to have a school building that will take care of the south part of the town. And so they made a decision that they would purchase the large square area that was between Douglas and Craig and Park and Fifth, a whole block in there.
Okay.
Several lots that were there. And they built on the east side of the lot. And so that meant a large area that could be developed for other purposes related to the school.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a kind of a situation where people were looking and they were saying, okay, now, what are we going to do with all of this? How are we going to handle this new school? What will it be like? And so the community was very interested in this. The college was very interested in this. And they were trying to figure out, okay, now how do we handle all of this new school? And so lots and lots and lots of planning to make it a really, really nice school as well. So the way that they wanted to get involved in all of this was the fact that they would then try to do things that were very, very different from what people normally expected of schools. And so there was an invitation in 1917, an invitational and literary meet was advertised in the newspapers that would be held on the grounds of the Southside School. There would be an athletic meet that would take place involving the whole county. So anybody in the county, any county school could participate in this.
Oh, cool.
And then there was going to be a literary part of it. And the literary part of it was going to then take place in the Austin Opera House downtown, which is Gopher's Grill of the present.
Okay.
Gotcha. So Opera House here. And so the Opera House was going to be the center of where that literary meet was going to take place. So it involved the brains and it involved the muscle of the students, and they were going to have a big affair. Big parade was going to be conducted, you know, and people would be involved coming, marching all over the town, and athletics here and at the new school, and then downtown would have the intellectual part of everything. So it was a pretty exciting time there in 1917. Now, by the time we get into 1918, there were things that were taking place. Railroad was trying to develop some things here in town, completed a new roundhouse, and some switching facilities within about a half a mile of where the Craig's addition was going to, Craig's Terrace was going to be. There were a lot of men who were going to work in the railroads, and so there were parts of that area that were developed then that were appealing to some of the people who were going to be working in these facilities railroad-wise. And then there were other kinds of factories that were coming into town. But especially there was stress placed upon the fact that this was so close to the college, and that would provide really good housing then for anybody who was teaching at the college or in the administration of the college, you know, that sort of thing. And so a lot of employers, a lot of employees of the college then were involved in coming in and settling in the Craig's Terrace area. And they also knew that they could build houses in there that could be used in a fashion that would house the students who were coming into town. Lots of students who were going to be needing housing, so some of the houses that could be built, you know, in this new area, perhaps, would complement what had been built on the other side of Wabash Avenue, because there were college housing units there
as well. Hand in hand, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the thing that was very interesting to me, though, in looking at this, was that Kagi Realty, the Kagi family was very, very critical family in early Effingham County history and Effingham City history, and it continued to be very important in terms of business with the realty firm. And the realty firm was located in the First National Bank building, which still exists today. It is no longer that. There's that's the exchange site downtown. And so the Craig Kagi Realty was located in that building, and they were advertising to the fullest extent possible to get people to look at what was taking place down here on the south side of town, looking at the potential that was there for good, decent housing, brick houses, solid houses, and they were close to school. So if their kids wouldn't have to walk a long distance to go to school, you know, so a selling point. And so over and over and over again, then those kinds of things were being advertised to the public. And then there were things that also began to transpire that were kind of interesting as I was looking at putting all this material together, because I found a very interesting story from 1918. In 1918, I found a picture of the school grounds in 1918. The school and then this vast expanse that is out there on the west side of the school grounds. A track had been built there for running, you know, for the high school was the old central school downtown, which is today is the parking lot for the First Baptist Church. Okay. And so there was that kind of facility that, because where central school was, there was no place to build a track for having track meets and things of that sort. So the new school grounds provided an excellent opportunity for having a decent track. And they could play football down there, too, you know, those kinds of things, because it was a wide-open area. And as they're looking, then, they have this large open field. And in 1918, in December or late November, it's not quite clear to me, all of a sudden, three airplanes came in and landed on that field. And they were having, apparently were having some difficulty. And so the mechanics who were with them then, you know, did whatever they had to do to get materials. They needed gas. They needed oil. They needed to be fixed up before they could get out of here. But Effingham was a spot where they saw this big open field, and they put their planes down there, which I thought was a really unique thing for any school history to have, you know. Three airplanes landed on our field today.
Unannounced, yeah.
Yes. And so, this was a different part of time. We talked about this in earlier broadcasts, I think, about the airport here in Effingham and how it developed and grew.
Yeah.
Well, there were these landing spots, oftentimes on farm ground. And so these pilots didn't see where there were landing fields that were scattered around on farm ground. But they saw this one. There was a big open area there, and they put their planes down there. And then after waiting around for overnight thing, then they were ready to hop in their planes and go again. And then they came back and talked about their experience here. Now, by the end of the 1920s, Dr. Henry had not built his house yet, but he decided in 1929 that he would build his house at the corner of Wabash and 5th Street.
Okay.
Beautiful, beautiful house. And it was described in the newspaper, incredible in terms of all the really nice things that were in as part of that construction. And it that was kind of the capstone there, I think, as I look at the newspapers, kind of the capstone of the neighborhood. And it was one that was such that people could look with great pride. They lived in a really nice neighborhood. And the community could look and say to visitors who were coming in, look at what we can offer you.
Yeah.
And so to me, it was a fascinating story about the ingenuity, the foresight of the community leaders, of the realtor who headed up all of this, of just in general, the people who had worked behind the scenes, man who headed up a concrete company here in Effingham, then he took charge pretty well of getting concrete streets where they needed to be in town and all that kind of thing. Because it was we want to make Effingham a showcase. And they were certainly trying to do that.
Yeah, and it's really cool to hear how they changed plans as the environment kind of changed around them.
Hmm.
Like you said, that during World War I, they kind of one person paused their plans because they didn't know if they were going to have a future there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so this is a social history, you know,
yeah.
in reality. Nothing, I did not see anything political, you know, in any of this research, except for the fact that City Council had to put their stamp of approval on the development of the neighborhood, and that was about the extent of the politics behind it. But it was more the economic forces, the social forces that were out there, and that's a very, very important part of any community that we tend to overlook. You know, most history is focused on politics rather than anything else, but that social history and that economic history is very, very interesting history, too.
Yeah, it kind of gives a background on how Effingham came to be what it is today in different ways, different renovations here and there, and it all comes together by the end of it.
Exactly.